Okay, so I might as well get started. I'll come back.
Super soft.
This is the super soft afternoon. So this is the question. Are super soft X-ray sources progenitors of type 1A supernovae? If this were an easy question, we could leave here knowing that the answer is yes or no. But that's an idea, actually. But unless one of my colleagues has something explosive to announce here today, I'm afraid that we're going to leave with some open questions. And so I think we have a nice lineup here today to really address all of the fundamental questions. And I'll take some time in my talk both to tell you something new and also to set the stage for Ken, Ed, and Jean-Pierre, why those particular things that they're going to be discussing are especially important. So we asked the question, are SSSs type 1A progenitors? But really the interesting question, the physical question that we want to get at, is whether accreting white dwarfs are type 1A progenitors. And SSSs are at best a clue to the answer to that question. So over here, you know, I'll talk a little bit about extragalactic studies toward the end of the talk. And they clearly indicate, at least I think, that not all supersoft sources are white dwarfs at all. Some of them may well be massive accreting objects, perhaps black holes whose masses are in excess of 50 solar masses. Some of them are kind of odd things we find near the centers of galaxies, and we don't know what they are. But if white dwarfs accrete and they need to burn the matter that they accrete in order to keep it, then it's very likely that almost all accreting white dwarfs have the potential to be supersoft sources at some point during their evolution. So what do you need for a single degenerate model to work? Well, certainly you need a white dwarf. And you need a source of mass, and enough mass that you generally are referring to a companion. The companion needs to have enough mass to bring the mass of the white dwarf over 1.4 solar masses, or the Chandrasekhar mass, or whatever limit you think is appropriate. And it generally needs a little more than that, too, because the mass transfer process may not be conservative. Now, the mass, we think, must be burned in order for the white dwarf to retain it. And as Ken will discuss, this places limits on the mass transfer rate. Oops, there we go. Well, it doesn't seem to want to show that graph. I suppose that's okay, because I think Ken will have a better version of it, as probably will Ed, I imagine. But here we have result of something that goes back to Ken's work and the work of others about a decade before supersoft sources were discovered, when it was recognized that in order to steadily burn matter, you have to be in a kind of a narrow range of M dot, and that range depends on the mass of the white dwarf. For a solar mass white dwarf, it's around 10 to the minus 7 solar masses per year. Yeah, now I'm in trouble. I'm not recording, oh no. So if you're substantially below that, then it depends on how much you're below it. Let's see if this will work. Okay, it will. If you're down here someplace, very far below it, you probably have nova explosions, classical novae with long time delays in between. And the standard picture is that you're losing mass, or at least not actually gaining much mass in this period. As you come close, you have the opportunity to have more novae. The time between novae changes. It's possible that you gain some mass in that. We had a very nice talk by Ken early in this session about the challenges to this model and an answer to those challenges. So I think this basic picture, the details may change, but the basic picture seems to hold water right now. Okay, and the fact that you need to be in this range of rather high mass transfer rates puts some limits on what the donor must be like. In order to achieve high rates, generally the donor has to be somewhat more massive than the white dwarf and also somewhat evolved. And if you notice, if we go back to the picture, this also places some limits on the temperature and on the luminosity of the system. That if you have these high M dots and the mass is being burned, these systems are highly luminous, typically around 10 to the 38 solar, 10 to the 38 ergs per second when you near the Chandrasekhar mass. Okay. So the early 1990s, ROSAT had one of the great successes of its time with the discovery of a class of sources, supersoft X-ray sources. As I understand it, I wasn't here, but Ed and Ken were here. Jochen Trumper came here to Santa Barbara to talk about these things to a workshop on pulsars. Okay, and actually, they immediately recognized these could very well be the things we're looking for, that these are very likely to be accreting white dwarfs that are burning material. So L and KT are in the right range, 10 to the 36 to 10 to the 38 ergs per second, temperatures of tens of EV. Ed and Ken and their collaborators developed a binary model in which the donor could give mass at the appropriate rate so that the matter could be burned when it fell onto the surface of the white dwarf. And there was a beautiful self-consistency to the whole thing. It all seemed to make sense. It all seemed to fit. And right now there are about 9 candidates in the galaxy in the Magellanic Clouds for the kind of binary they envision, which we've called close binary supersoft sources. So this is the donor is not a giant and it's in Roche lobe contact with the white dwarf. Now, question is, we think these could be that, the supersoft sources could be these types of systems, but really nobody had ever considered from first principles whether you expect there to be enough binaries in the galaxy that we should see such systems. And so Saul Rappaport and an undergraduate at that time, J.D. Smith, and I approached this question to try to predict from first principles how many close binary supersoft sources would there be. And we found...
2004, but it was 1994.
That's right, it was 1994, thank you. Right. I'll have to change that, right? So I don't care about priority or anything like that. Yeah, so it was 1994, actually, we did that. And what we found is a couple of things. First of all, the results, we ran through many different simulations. And for most reasonable choices of the initial binary population, we had about 1,000 of these systems active in the galaxy at any time. And shortly thereafter, Jungelson et al. Did a calculation which complemented this one, and they found a slightly smaller number, but I would say compatible with this, given the uncertainties in the calculations. They also did a nice thing, which I may come back to, which is that they didn't just look at this class of source, they looked at other classes of accreting white dwarfs, because the simulations have lots of different pathways to interesting systems. And so by looking at other classes of things, you have a kind of a normalization that you can go back to. You have consistency checks. Now, I'd like to point out one thing about this graph from our paper, and that is, as the white dwarf mass increases, the luminosity increases, and the higher luminosity systems are associated also with higher temperature. So it's harder to hide those systems where the mass is close to the Chandrasekhar mass. I'll come back to that theme several times. Okay, well now we said, oh yeah, there are 1,000 of these things in the galaxy and in M31, but is that embarrassing given the fact that we only found a handful in the galaxy and 15 at that time in M31? Well, we know that these systems, because they're emitting such soft radiation, radiation is highly ionizing and very readily absorbed, so we know that they're going to be hidden by interstellar material. And so we did a simulation where we modeled our own galaxy M31 and the Magellanic Clouds. We took some reasonable galactic models for the gas distribution. We used the super soft sources that were observed, their luminosities and temperatures, and we used also a population that came from our simulations to seed these galaxies with super soft sources and see how many of them we would detect. We found that generally, you know, the few that we see could easily correspond to around 1,000 or so that would be active both in our galaxy and in M31. In fact, there could be many more if they have lower temperatures and lower luminosities, and we now think there is a lower temperature, lower luminosity extension of the class, but that's not so relevant to us because for the type 1a supernovae, we're interested in the more massive white dwarfs that tend to have higher luminosity and higher temperature. Okay, so what do they look like? There was still a chance that they could be self-absorbed, right? In particular, what does the disk do? And this is exactly what Jean-Pierre is going to be discussing. What does the disk do? In a preliminary calculation, Bob Popham and I generated a graph like this, which you probably can't see very well, but it helped us to understand what we think the answer to two important questions, what those answers are. One of them is if you ask, does the disk obscure the source? You might get a thick disk, might make it hard to see the soft radiation. But what we found is that the inner disk itself became so hot that it was also emitting super soft radiation. So at least for some ranges of reasonable system parameters, it seemed as if the disks may not obscure the source. And we also found that the disk itself was so luminous, not because of the high accretion rate, but because of the fact that the inner object is so much more luminous than the accretion luminosity, that it is providing energy to the disk. The disk becomes so much more luminous that actually it can hide the donor, which has been a puzzle for super soft sources because we don't know what the donors are, what they look like. Yeah, we guess from the models, but there's very little direct information about the donor stars. And how can that be? Well, it seems as if the disk may be providing most of the optical radiation. So there's a lot of work to do on the disks, as Jean-Pierre will describe. Are there winds from the disks? And of course, not even all systems may have disks because we may have some wind-driven systems. The role of magnetic fields has not been explored. So this is a very interesting area for further discovery. And I think we know a few important things about it, but there's much still to be learned. And it relates to what these should look like. Now, the other distinctive thing about super soft sources is whatever they are, whether they ever become type 1a supernovae or not, they are emitting incredible amounts of highly ionizing radiation. And they can therefore ionize huge volumes of the ISM around them, thereby creating a nebula. And just as the disks were very distinctive, and, you know, very sort of a different type of calculations that one needs to do, or at least a different regime of parameters that one is considering. So too for the nebulae, it's very distinctive because many nebulae that we're familiar with, you have the system losing mass. Planetary nebula, where a star loses a lot of its envelope. Supernova remnant, where the mass comes from the progenitor star. In this case, the super soft source may not be contributing to the surrounding, to the mass around it. Even if it doesn't contribute mass to the surroundings around it, it's ionizing them. So this great bulk of ionized material comes not from material ejected by the source, but it's just the ISM around it. It's lighting up its own environment. And Eugene Chang and collaborators did a number of studies on sensitivity, for example, to the duty cycle. It's not very sensitive to the duty cycle of super soft activity. Yet, of roughly 18 local sources, only one of them has been observed to have this nebula. And I would say of the nine, the ones we're really interested in are the nine that are the possible close binary supersoft sources. For example, there is one that has a planetary nebula, but that's a different kind of system. So for these nine, we only find one. That is a mystery that we don't understand. That's a puzzle. And it may have something to do with the way these systems appear pre-supernova, if some of them are indeed supernova progenitors. And so we need to consider that when we consider what the late time evolution of the supernova is, and also the supernova remnant, what the supernova remnant should look like. Okay, now what about the evolution? Well, this is where Ed steps in. He's going to be focusing on the binary evolution. So I'm not going to go through these equations in detail. I just want to emphasize one point. And that, I'm sure, and Ed has already emphasized this in a previous talk, and so has Lorne. In these systems, you would like the mass transfer rate to be high. In order to achieve that, you have to have a donor which is typically somewhat more massive than the white dwarf, and or possibly somewhat evolved. Helium core mass typically in excess of 0.1 solar masses. Now, under this situation, when the donor transfers mass to the white dwarf, the separation between the two can become smaller.
You exclude from your supersoft sources the Krasnovia.
These are the classical
classes. Yeah, I'm just talking about the binaries now, right?
Because there's also some strangers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Some don't need to have any. They just burn longer.
Well, why? Yes, there are some. Certainly, we're learning something about novae. Right, right. Now, this is an example of something where the supersoft source is a white dwarf, which has experienced some nuclear burning recently. And whether or not we understand why some of them appear as supersoft sources and many don't, and why some have longer episodes of supersoft behavior than have been predicted, that's another mystery. I'm not going to focus on that at all, though, because in those cases, the donor is probably much less massive, and therefore they're not candidates for supernovae. Right. Yeah, for this discussion, that's right. But what is important here is that if the Roche lobe shrinks as the donor is giving mass, the donor's response, both to having given mass and to the shrinking of the Roche lobe, is very important, and it determines what will happen next. The first calculations to do this from first principle were actually done by Lorne. We worked together on a combination population synthesis and binary evolution code, in which for the first time he connected up a Henier model to the to explain what's happening to the donor and follow its evolution. So that I think this was a step where the binary evolution calculations became more realistic. And he talked a little about that last time. And the key is here, you can predict M dot from first principles just using conservation of angular momentum, the Roche lobe filling condition, and the input on the evolution of the donor star. There's a denominator that comes into play. You'd like that to be small, for M dot to be large enough to put us in the super soft regime. But if it's too small, and in particular, if it passes through zero, then you have dynamically unstable mass transfer and the possibility of a common envelope, which would truncate the evolution, presumably, and lead to a double degenerate binary, or something interesting. It might be something different from a double degenerate binary, but falls out of our calculations at that point. So there's a condition that allows us to avoid a common envelope. Is that condition satisfied or not? Well, we did the population synthesis in a way that mirrored what Saul and I and JD had done. We computed the evolution of every system. And what we found, well, here's an example of what we found. Lorne showed a beautiful picture like this, actually a nicer one, where he varied the mass of the donor star. So to complement what he showed last week, I'm showing what happens when you change the core mass of the donor star. For larger core masses, more evolved donors, you can reach the steady nuclear burning regime and gain significant mass. Because we included the possibility that recurrent novae could also retain mass, we can see that even where we didn't reach the steady burning limit, we still had some mass increase. And after we came out of it, we still had some mass increase. But there's an important thing to notice here, which is that you certainly have a very low rate of mass increase. And it would be a great coincidence if you were able to do it without having gain enough mass without having an episode of quasi-steady nuclear burning. In this upper region, which I think was well demonstrated in Lorne's picture last week, in this upper region, not all of the mass can be burned. And what happens to that can be problematic. If it leaves the system, that's going to enhance the chance that you can have a successful binary evolution. And that's something that Ken is also going to be talking about.
In your estimate you mentioned before of the number of sources, this was taken into account.
Yes. Well, the earlier one, the first one that we did with Saul, the evolution was done in a very crude way. Turned out to give reasonably good results. We were fairly conservative. It was only the ones that included the full evolution that I think can be taken seriously as predictions for type 1a supernova rate. But what we found is the following. What we found is that if you assumed conservative mass transfer, then you know, even though enough systems exist to potentially be type 1a progenitors, that is, they could match the rate of formation of mass transfer systems matches the rate of type 1a supernovae, that unless the system can get rid of most of the mass in the early stages, while the mass ratio still is such that the donor is much more massive or potentially significantly more massive than the white dwarf, that the systems risk common envelope. So there are enough of them, the rates are adequate, but only under the assumption that significant mass is ejected from the system and that when it's ejected, it doesn't carry a lot of angular momentum. And this is work we presented in 1995 at the Spain conference. And shortly thereafter, Ken and his team came up with the idea that perhaps winds are expected when the white dwarf can't burn all of the material. And I'm sure he'll be discussing that as well. So what is the physics here? I mean, I think what I've said is that right now the answer could be just about anything, right? So this is the physics that we have to explore. Is it a happy face? Is it a frog? No. Is it a creating system? Okay. Here's the donor, right? Don't you recognize it? Here's a white dwarf. Okay. If there's Roche lobe overflow, we have a flow through none other than the disk. Okay. Now, it could be that if this donor is a little bit more evolved, it is emitting a wind. That would be a slow wind, presumably. And that wind may, some of it may be captured by the white dwarf. The white dwarf may, according to Ken and his colleagues, also be ejecting a wind, and that wind's likely to be a fast wind. It's unlikely that some of it's going to be captured by the companion, but it could be that some of the wind actually impacts the companion and influences what happens to it. The disk itself could be ejecting a wind, and some of that might be captured by either of the other stars in the system. And the donor star may itself eject a wind that it would not be ejecting were it in isolation because of radiation and the effect of wind impacting on it. And I don't know what speed that is. So this is potentially a very complex system. And as Lauren showed last week, if we summarize this by two parameters, the amount of mass that is retained, the fraction of mass that's retained by the white dwarf, and the angular momentum carried away, the specific angular momentum carried away by mass that exits the system, we can, you know, have a manageable form of the equations, and we can make whatever we want happen by choosing those parameters in a favorable way. And the circumbinary disk. Okay. I was just simple. I need another color and something color like this. Right. Well, don't forget about the possibility of another companion in the system too. Is there a lot of three body scenarios? So, you know, can we do this? Well, look, the full range of binary models includes symbiotics, which Lev and his colleagues showed that usually don't have mass transfer for long enough to do it. But, you know, so you have some wind systems as well as Roche-Loeb systems. For each one, there are something like 17 parameters, which I won't go over right now, that you need to determine the stability of the mass transfer and to compute the final state. So can these systems, can these accreting white dwarfs be type 1a progenitors? Well, sure, and we can do it in our calculations, but the question is, how does nature do it, and does nature do it? Nature knows how to compute these parameters, but we're only learning how to do it. So that's why the answer, I think, even after Ed is finished, I'll bet the answer is going to be maybe, but we'll see, because he's the one who's going to go over all of these models. So, I really think there's nothing I want to add there. I want to move on to something, well, this comes up to Peter Lundquist's talk and Massimo's talk yesterday. Okay, believe it or not. Same sort of picture we had for the binary evolution. This also determines what the late time evolution of the supernova and what the supernova remnant will look like. It's these same questions of how much mass is put into the ISM at what speeds, carrying what angular momentum, and how much irradiation there is. So it's the same things that we need to understand. And one might say, well, that's too bad, it's so complicated. But I think the nice thing about it is that the kind of work that people have been doing may give us some insight to constraints on this basic picture, what's happening here. So I think we could take it as a hopeful thing that presumably there are some genuine predictions we make based on the binary models. Okay, so that was what I wanted to say. Let's move on. Oddly enough, after how many years are now? 17 years of supersoft sources? Okay, 16. We still really don't know very much about the individual sources in the galaxy and the Magellanic Cloud. We're learning more about them, and a lot of great work has been done. But it seemed to me at some point it was important to look at other galaxies, and I got very involved in working with Chandra and even with XMM to do that. Here's a picture of the center of M31, and you notice that these sources are all supersoft sources. That's the nucleus of the galaxy, and there's a big cluster of them right at the center. In fact, within 10 parsecs of the central black hole, there is an active supersoft source. And it's not only for M31, there's another place this can be checked, M32, same thing there. It's harder to check it as you go further out because you can't resolve the sources. Why is that? My guess is these are not standard binaries. I have a theory, but I won't go through it now because I'd like to focus on the standard binaries for this talk. There are also supersoft sources in the disk. Okay? And some of them, this is actually, believe it or not, an H-alpha image. So these dots you see are regions where there's H-alpha. This is a picture of the nucleus again, a little bit blown up. This source, R212, is just a remarkable source. Maybe we'll talk about that sometime in the future. Whoops. That's the disk, where you can see that in some cases there's some correspondence between regions with H-alpha and regions where the sources are located. That could be because of the sources themselves, or it could be because they're in regions where stars are being formed. So we now know of hundreds in honor of Ed's birthday last summer. We wrote a paper on the 10 facts of life for super soft sources, and I won't have a chance to talk about much of that. All I will say is that because some are so close to the central black hole, they could be something else. And also, in a couple of cases, these sources have luminosities of 10 to the 40, 10 to the 41 Earths per second. They're probably not white dwarfs. But it could be that many of the rest of them are white dwarfs. We don't know. What about the ones that are white dwarfs, and what can we say about those that may be approaching the Chandrasekhar limit? They're high luminosity sources. They have high temperatures, and they're not generally hidden by the interstellar medium. Okay, I don't know if you can see this. This is for a 100 EV source. This is 10 to the 22 in NH, and you can see that the count rate, which probably something over here or down here corresponds to detectability with a reasonable Chandra exposure in M31. This is done for M31. You would certainly detect sources that are 10 to the 38 ergs per second, 10 to the 37, maybe even 10 to the 36 ergs per second if they were near the Chandrasekhar mass and had the appropriate luminosity and temperature. So we probably see everything close to the Chandrasekhar limit in M31. And we'll skip that for now. So I claim we should detect hundreds of sources if the Chandrasekhar mass model is correct and if these sources are visible as supersoft sources, because, and this is hard to see, if the accretion rate is, say, m dot over 4 times 10 to the minus 7 solar masses per year, the efficiency is beta, and you have to gain 0.2 solar masses to become a Chandrasekhar mass supernova, then you'll be active for a few times 10 to the 5 years. Maybe longer, maybe somewhat shorter, but that range. And so you ask yourself how many of them are close enough to the Chandrasekhar mass that we should see them, and the number comes out to be over 1,000. You might be able to push it down to 100, I don't know, that with different assumptions. But you expect there to be a lot of these things. If every supernova, type 1a supernova, has to reach the Chandrasekhar mass, and if such a system can be detected as a supersoft source. Therefore, we can now, because we detect typically about 10 of them, okay, maybe less, maybe more, I can't tell you if that's typically 10 or 20 or 5 of the right type, but I can tell you it's not 1,000. I can tell you it's not 100. So I think we can rule out that Chandrasekhar mass accreting nuclear burning white dwarf models are the dominant channel if they must appear as supersoft sources when most of the mass is gained. Okay, so what's happening? Does that mean that the Chandrasekhar models are dead? I don't think so. I don't think we can say that, because obscuration could play a role, for example, by winds. Of course, and this is something that Carlos talked about, and we've had it in a couple of the other talks too, winds can open up a cavity around the source and can also set the stage for post-explosion interactions, which are testable. So the winds have some predictability. And that's important. So we can't just say, oh, obscuration gets rid of, you know, explains why we don't see them, because obscuration itself has consequences that we can test. Similarly,
interstellar obscuration, that's what you
mean. No, this now, I would mean this obscuration, because interstellar obscuration can't do it.
No,
so I'm saying, yeah, and the disk may not ordinarily do it, so maybe winds do it. Maybe the system dirties up its surroundings and obscures itself, it hides itself. But if it does that, that's testable in the post-supernova phase. Now what about photospheric expansion? Maybe, you know, during this heavy nuclear burning phase, the photosphere is actually bigger than we think, and so they're not as hot, and they can be more easily hidden. Well, if that's the case, unless you bring it down below, you know, 15 EV or so, which is hard to do, be too big, I think. You're still going to have a lot of photoionizing radiation, and that could be testable both pre- and post-explosion, because you might expect to see the nebulae pre-explosion. I've actually skipped over a whole part of the talk where I talked about the nebulae, but we can chat about that offline sometime. And what about duty cycle? This comes to something that I know many of us have been interested in, and in particular, I know Ken's group has the recurrent NOVI models. Well, you know, the thing is that you still have to mask the radiation, because having this duty cycle where you're only on some of the time doesn't help unless you're burning all the time and you're only seeing for some of the time. So if you just had a low duty cycle for burning, you just have more systems that are doing it for shorter period, you know, more flickering of a larger number of systems. So you can't do it that way either without also invoking obscuration or a bigger photosphere. Right, right. Same number of observables, so but... Exactly, exactly, right, right. So this is my concluding slide, and I leave this for my collaborators and colleagues to do the difficult work here, because I think it's likely that all progenitors do experience some stage of steady nuclear burning. They may look like super soft sources all or part of the time, but it really comes down to basic physics, understanding the predictions well enough, which really requires a lot of hard work in the physics, and also using the observations both pre- and post-explosion to constrain the models. Okay, and with that, I'm going to turn the floor over to Ken.
If it turns out that the donors are precluded because we see too much hydrogen from the donors, that may knock out single degenerate models anyway.
Okay, the I'm using several old slides which you might have seen before, and so let me start from kind of general the setting of the problem like this. As already the Rosanne said, the question for the type 1 progenitor is still doesn't so much clear yet. The question has been if it's a single degenerate or a double degenerate, or a Chandrasekhar mass white dwarf or a sub-Chandrasekhar mass white dwarf at the explosion. And so I have several reasons to prefer the single degenerate scenarios and Chandrasekhar mass white dwarf models. So I was just pushing that direction here in my talk, but in that scenario, the big question is what is really this white dwarf companions, and how or under what conditions the white dwarf mass can grow to the Chandrasekhar limit. And also we have the now study the kind of diversity of type 1 supernova. So we have to study the dependence on the initial mass of the white dwarf, not at explosion, but initial. At the beginning of the accretion, and the metallicity of the white dwarf and the rotation of the white dwarf, probably this is important to explain some diversity And also the companions has metallicity and age dependence. And we have to answer why the type 1A has some difference between ellipticals and spirals, and how it evolves along redshift, for example. So, and can we explain just rate or evolution naturally? Or, and the biggest question now is the yesterday Massimo discussed the circumstellar interaction. So, but this is a quite broad topics, and we just focus. I focus on this particular scenario of the super soft X-ray, the evolution. So my task is just kind of provide a basic physics of accreting white dwarf, and let me start just my some movie calculated by my good friend Matsuda. Quite nice simulation, beautiful. This is the, presumably this is a black hole rather than white dwarf, but the basic the simulation pictures are physics is similar, hydrodynamics. And for white dwarfs accreting material from the companion, the important parameter for the evolution is the M dot, mass accretion rate. Because the accretion provides the energy from the gravitational energy release by compression, so-called compression heating, and this, so the energy release time scale depends on M dot. And that is competing with the radiative cooling at the surface. So the compression heating and radiative cooling determine the evolutionary path of the accreted material in the density and temperature plane. So basically, the accreted material is compressed by accretion, but its temperature history along density depends on this M dot. Just so if the accretion is very fast, in the extreme case, this just along adiabatic compression going to. And if the accretion is slow, the relative cooling is important. So in extreme case, it's almost isothermal along this. So the slow accretion leads to the assuming this is the ignition line for some certain nuclear burning like hydrogen, helium, or carbon, the slower accretion, or slower M dot, leads to the ignition density at high density ignition. So that becomes more explosive. That's basic physics of the accretion. So because of that effect of M dot, the fate of the accreting material just depends on basically M dot. And so our goal is to get the Chandrasekhar mass and igniting carbon in the central region. And the preferable scenario is with the accreting material is not much lost from the accreting white dwarf. So in principle, the weaker nuclear burning is preferable. So that means a higher M dot case is preferable for the type 1A scenario. And so it's kind of long way of evolution. Hydrogen is burning to make helium, and helium is making a burn to make carbon oxygen and so on. And but if the accretion rate is slow, we have a danger to have a nova-like explosion to lose a lot of mass. Well, in some cases, the helium could be detonated, like here in the point, and that is the base of the sub-Chandra type 1 model. So this is the general behavior of the accreting material with the nuclear burning. As a function of the white dwarf mass during the accretion and the M dot. So the M dot is 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 10, and so on. And these values are the mass of the hydrogen rich envelope when hydrogen is ignited. So it's typically very small. If especially if the Chandrasekhar mass is reached, the order of 10 to the minus 7 solar mass is enough to have ignite hydrogen. So the hydrogen is basically almost negligible at the Chandrasekhar limit. But there is some the steady burning regions which has been discussed a lot. So and I will briefly touch on this. And so the just for the basics, main reason why the most of the region is the shows the unstable nuclear burning, unstable hydrogen burning is the following. As I said, the mass of the hydrogen rich layer at ignition is very small compared with the white dwarf mass, 10 to the minus, at most 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 4, and in the extreme case, 10 to the minus 7. And in that case, the radius thickness is also very small compared with the radius of the white dwarf. So the pressure at the bottom of the burning region, accreted material, is just given by the weight of the overlying material. So this gives the balance between the gravitational force and the pressure times the surface area. So the pressure doesn't change even if nuclear burning is going on here and temperature becomes high and high. So it's a kind of the very heavy layer overlying about nuclear burning. So ordinary nuclear burning cannot lift up the overlying layer, and so that makes the nuclear burning very unstable. So we have two effects of the instability of the hydrogen burning shell. The one is geometry, as I said. If it's plane parallel, even if the equation of state is ideal gas, the nuclear burning is quite unstable. And the second effect, of course, the electrons are, in some cases, quite degenerate. And that also makes the pressure of the material here almost temperature independent for both effects. But if the surface area gets higher, a higher temperature because of the high m dot or high luminosity underlying this layer it's providing, then the surface region expands, and if the radius is comparable to the whole radius of the white dwarf, then this situation is completely opposite. So the so-called specific fit becomes negative, and nuclear burning becomes stable. So we can construct this kind of steady burning regions. Steady means accreting material is processed by nuclear burning at the same rate of accretion. So there has been done many groups, including this place. And as I said, mass is very small, and we have found several stable regions. And this stable region corresponds to the very high luminosity, as I said. And this is the HR diagram of the white dwarf. And so as far as the white dwarf can be regarded as kind of the same radius as the initial white dwarf, and the accreting material is regarded as kind of thin layer, it becomes unstable. But if the luminosity gets higher and higher and close to the Eddington limit, then of course the equation of state is now different. And also the geometry can be regarded as more like a spherical here. So it's gradually expanding. So these regions are quite stable, but they only for relatively narrow region in the luminosity. So that's why this stable region is relatively narrow, and most of the region becomes most of the regions hydrogen are unstable. So if unstable, you can guess what I'm seeing. This is a repeating of the Novak explosions. Hydrogen-rich gas is accreting and unstable burning. Yeah, the ignites nova explosions and expels the gas, and then next cycle starts. Cannot be steady. And then even the nova explosions in the wind, it shows a wind after the explosion phase, and it shows super soft phases. So, and the recurrent nova also shows some super soft phases. So, there are many cases which the star shows the super soft phase. And this picture I thought very simple, but now, the 3 years ago, the Sumner Starfield challenged this picture pretty clearly. And he showed in numerical simulations the even 10 to the minus 8 solar mass per year in M dot leads to the stable burning rather than nova explosion. And so if we believe Sumner's result, we are quite happy to have a very wide region for the accreting fight of just go to Chandrasekhar limit. But unfortunately, I examined these examples and found that it's completely numerical, non-physical.
It doesn't have
any resolution, does it? No, that's my main conclusion. So just quickly explain, because this is probably important for this community. And this is the Sumner's models. He put so-called surface zones about 10 to the minus 5 solar mass. That is only one zone. And so as I said, the pressure at the bottom of this one zone is given by these simple equations. And that corresponds to the temperature quite high, already exceeding 10 to the 8. So if we put accreting, if we accrete hydrogen into this zone, in one time step, it's quickly burned into helium and even carbon, neon, in one time step, because of this high temperature. This is forced to be there because of this high, quite a large mass zone.
According to Frank Timmies, they looked at much smaller mass zones, so I don't know, we can have a good argument in a couple of weeks.
He got that.
Yeah, he said that Starfield et al. They looked at small mass zones. So they published it. They're looking at it.
Yeah, what I said is we need the mass zone 10 to the minus 7, not half 5.
Right, yeah, he said he went to the
one. Okay, that's right. Yeah, I tested this very thick model with just putting hydrogen and very quickly burn into uranium. So in that model, the nuclear burning rate is not temperature dependent at all, just depends on time step. Energy released by just time step, so it cannot be unstable, just peacefully burning in steady fashion by in completely numerical manner. So we need to really be using the very much fine mesh point at least to test this hypothesis. So I gave this talk just in front of Sumner 3 years ago. And he agreed to use small mass mesh point, and but numerically at that time he said he couldn't. So we have to wait. still, I think this picture is correct. But the question is now this red giant regions. And I did a long time ago just very simple numerical simulation to accrete matter at this high rate. And this material is just being piled up on the white dwarf because time scale of nuclear burning is much longer than the time scale of the accretion. Then, if this is the case, whole this region, going to the common envelope phase, and at least single degeneration doesn't work for this region. Now, the good idea came from my colleague Hachisan Kato, and they calculate, they have been working on Nova wind and applies the result to the case of the high accretion rate. And their point is they at that time they adopted new open opacity and which has quite high the opacity around this temperature due to the iron. And around if the accretion rate is close to the Dinton limit, and the this high opacity produces this kind of locally super Dinton region, so it's drive the wind by radiation pressure. So at higher density, at the accretion rate higher than the critical mass accretion rate, that correspond to this correspond to the Paczynski's the core mass luminosity relation in for AGB stars. The accretion drives the wind like this. They calculate only the spherical model, so it's just spherical winds. And so that rescue too much expansion of the white dwarf. So this shows the they calculated the kind of sequence of the steady accretion models and giving a relation between M dot and photosphere of the white dwarf. With the wind solutions, the white dwarf radius is much larger than the initial radius here, and by factor of 10^100 and so on. But but not really exceeding the Rochelle to make the common envelope. And the wind velocity reaches almost the 1,000 kilometers per second, even exceeding that one. And because in order to offer the material to get out of the white dwarf, the velocity should exceed the escape velocity, so which should be higher than 1,000 kilometers per second. So their result, the radius and looks like this. White dwarf looks like a bit expanded, like this. So probably that is consistent with the super soft X ray sources. That's the main idea for the origin of this. At that time we saw this is a kind of error box, but I will show you more example.
Maybe we can also point out on this map for Cal 83 and 87.
Ah.
I think 87 is the green one.
Ah.
It should be red because it's soft. But it's, I think this is the
other one. This one.
And the other one is all foreground stars with stellar coronas.
Ah.
Well, there's one more, I think. One of them is this shine source, but I don't know what it is.
I think I got this plot from Joachim 10 years ago or something. I don't know.
The blue ones are just the neutron stars in the black.
Ah, I see.
This
is the HR diagram taken from the Sumner Starfield's plot, and so they located those super soft X-ray sources in this HR diagram, and I think his point is his model can be consistent with low luminous super soft, but I think the error is probably quite large for this, and consistent with this. Regions. And the other point is with the white dwarf with wind, the radius is as large as here. So which can explain slightly expanded case compared with the original white dwarf radius. It's here. So the 3×10^5. Degree. So this is Sumner's Stafford model. So it's, I don't think his model can explain this one. Mm-hmm. It's completed this along this line.
So I think the luminosities are a little bit accurate.
Yeah, I guess, I hope.
And that's actually true because at first the luminosities came out very high, super eddings, and then people said, okay, we need a white dwarf model atmosphere, and that moderates them, which it does. But then when you actually look at the spectra of them, with now that we have Chandra and XMM and they give a very good spectra, you find that sometimes we're totally fooled. Like with Cal 87, the white dwarf model atmosphere was a nice fit, but then when you actually look at the spectrum, there's no continuum whatsoever. It's only a line spectrum, an emission line spectrum. So, you know, but because it corresponds to something that was irradiated by a low KT source, there are no lines above 1 keV, and when you consider the blend of all of the lines, it looks like something like a white dwarf model atmosphere. Mm-hmm. So you can be very fooled. Your point is very well taken.
How is it with the other ones? Is there no continuum spectrum also?
No, the others, I think, Cal 87 is a special case because we're seeing it.
Because we look in the orbital plane.
Yeah.
Anyway, our point is the expansion, expanded structure of the wind emitting white dwarf is important to explain this, the temperature of the super source.
Is it 300,000 degrees proper temperature for super source, or too cool?
No, it's okay. Hmm? 300,000,
500,000, doesn't do the temperature. With all of the boxes. Then I would introduce, show just Hachisan Kato's recent work about kind of non-linear behavior of the super source models. Because so far we discussed kind of linear stability analysis and which region is stable, which region unstable. But important is the non-linear behavior is also can be explained by the models. And this is the kind of limit cycle model, so limit cycle-like behavior of the supersoft X-ray sources in LMC. And I was surprised they can explain this behavior very nicely in the wind models. And what in here is the, so underlying model is the, this is our assumption, but the companion is relatively slightly evolved main sequence models these people have developed. And so the mass transfer rate is given by the thermal time, Kelvin-Helmholtz time scale of the mass donor star, and it's given by this one. So for more massive stars, the accretion rate is a bit higher. And so this is an evolutionary effect, just gradually expanding. So, and as far as the companion star mass is higher than white dwarf mass, this is just continue. The other case is the giant with helium core, but it's a yes case. So it's more like this main sequence and white dwarf. White dwarf is here, and this is kind of accretion disk. And so in their models, what is happening is I think this, the time and brightness, optical brightness, and this is the beginning of the accretion, and the nuclear band is ignited, and the white dwarf becoming quickly getting bright. And they included both also luminosity from the companions and accretion disk itself being irradiated by white dwarf. But so I don't know which one is really which, but this case, the white dwarf gets quite bright. And then the brightening stops at this point B already, because at this point, the mass outflow, mass accretion from the main sequence to the white dwarf is stopped by itself. The reason is the wind from a great white dwarf hits the main sequence donor, and mass is stripping off quite a lot from this main sequence. And at that stage, the mass stripping rate is even exceeding the mass transfer rate itself. So that's then the expansion of the main sequence stops, and the accretion from the main sequence to the white dwarf also stops. So this stripping off effect is quite large, and I think this rate is even almost as high, one of the magnitude higher than the mass, the accretion rate. So, but at this point B, already the mass stripping off effect becomes effective to stop the mass transfer. And then afterwards, the mass accretion is still continuing, and the wind is continuing, but that is basically the disk evolution. This is the phase of disk evolution. And this time scale is just determined by this is still a mass accreting, but the time scale depends on the viscous time scale. And
is the white dwarf still burning?
Yeah. And from point C, this disk accretion also stops. But only the white dwarf, which has still undergoing nuclear burning, wind loss. But the accreting white dwarf, the accreted white dwarf just shrinks, envelope shrinks here. So
in that whole phase,
C X-rays. To D.
No X-rays.
And the interpretation is from A, B to D, there's a thick wind around. So they absorbed all X-rays.
Okay.
So they explain in this way, optically bright, but X-ray off phase here. And after here, the envelope of the white dwarf completely shrinks to the original radius, and then the surrounding material is cleaned up. So now the X-ray is visible, but optically faint. And the same thing starts, then again, mass accretion from the main sequence starts. So the underlying nuclear burning is steady burning, but behavior is completely not steady, but showing limit cycle.
So the mass transfer stops on what time scale? Shorter than the viscous time?
Yeah, even shorter. Because of the stripping effect, it's very.
The main sequence
stops expanding. So its radius is now below the Roche log.
It's been blown up by the X-ray, but by the X-ray, it's part of the X-ray.
Yeah, the X-ray is longer than the viscous time.
You have to.
Yes, with a time scale, you can refill the Roche low.
Any time scale you have the scale of the atmosphere, right? To move it is more 10^4 to 5 centimeters. Okay. I don't think it's realistic, because
this is the doesn't depend on the viscosity. This.
No, I know, but I don't. I don't think it is possible in the realistic parameters for the star to shrink or to expand or anything to do.
Because
time shorter than the time viscous time of a short disk.
No, it just depends on the Kelvin-Helmholtz time scale of the main sequence. Yeah.
It's even dynamical time scale, I think. Because
if we remove.
At that time, the star, if you take mass off, it's just on a dynamical.
Yeah, it's cool. Yes.
It's a radiative star, it stays inside the rope. So when you
strip it off, it's a radiative star.
Yeah, it should not be a convective.
Okay, so it's a radiative star.
It just slightly evolved off the main sequence.
Ken, I'm a little curious about the mass accretion efficiency, because the wind models are already losing a lot of mass for every gram of accrete, and now you're even pouring mass off the other stars, so you're going to need an even more massive transferring star to grow the white dwarf. Is that
So the I think we need the relatively massive the donor star, three solar mass donor star. Because about 50% is lost from the system, cannot be accreted.
It's a very massive.
What is the mass of the donor estimated to be in the?
In this case, we use the 3.5 solar mass donor star.
It's an 18-hour period, so you can finish this.
So cannot be one solar mass for this case. And this is the picture about accretion disk, and it's irradiated and it's extended, and the wind, when wind stops, it just shrinks, and when mass accretion starts, it's, the edges flare up or something like that, the picture.
I'm going to get
the mass transfer of such a system. So you have this 3.5 solar mass star and a white dwarf that's one solar mass or less. Won't that lead to a common envelope more quickly than this system can sort of set itself into the limit cycle? You know, that's classic setup for common envelope, right? And that takes place on a dynamical time scale. So is there really time for a disk to establish and for these, you know, radiation to start creating the winds and the system to stabilize itself before there's a common envelope?
So the, in the, that corresponds to the accretion rate exceeding 10 to the minus 6 and without wind. But with wind, that common envelope phase can be avoided. The wide of radius is not expanded.
But is it, what is the dynamic?
Because the energy is being lost.
But this is not a dynamical time scale. This has to be set up, right?
So no. Dynamical time scale you can look at the only the convective case. This is the radiative still.
You mean that dynamical time scale for the binary?
Yeah,
it's
for the binary.
Because you have unstable binary mass transfer, is that what you're...
You have a 3.5 solar mass star, or one solar mass star is unstable. You know, even if it's a radiative star, that's still unstable, unless you have a lot of mass that's lost from the system right away. So it has to have the risk.
But this is the kind of mass flow transfer takes place thermal time scale, because the if we remove the envelope in dynamical time scale, it shrinks, quickly shrinks. So it takes a time of the Kelvin-Helmholtz time scale for the expanding to fill the Rochelle.
Is this interesting phenomenology, or is this supposed to help count the type 1a supernova? We have kind of lost track. Isn't there sort of a population?
Yeah, it's a different scenario. Just we, I, for me, the. Not just the linear stability analysis, but also this kind of nonlinear behavior can be explained by this model is quite, for me, very impressive too.
But it will happen probably only if you are not too far from your upper limit of the stable burning region, isn't that? Would this really?
This occurs.
Not so far above the.
Yeah, this close to the burning region, but still wind regime.
Because then you really have a very high mass transfer rate. That's exactly
right. And we have another, the case of the supersoft X-ray sources, which show this kind of limit cycle behavior in optically high X-ray off, optically low X-ray on repetition. And the same model can be applied to explain for this system. So for me, this is quite convincing. These super soft X-ray sources actually really accreting wide off undergoing wind. And unless any other person can explain this behavior like this, then I change mind. But at the moment, only. then after super soft X-ray sources, the system going into the unstable nuclear binding regions, and wait a second, just I have to go. There, yeah. I have to finish quickly. So, in relation to the type 1A supernova, the typical evolution is going like this. The, in these wind regimes, the wide-off behaves like those supersoft X-ray sources, right? And in this phase, and then possibly, I don't know exactly, but quite a steady case is possible. And then the nuclear binding going into the region of the unstable case, and which shows the behavior of the recurrent novae, because the mass of the necessary to ignite hydrogen binding is only 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 6, but the accretion rate is 10 to the, in this case, the 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7 solar mass per year. So the time scale of the accumulating enough mass is only 10 to the 10 years. So this is correspond to the recurrent node. And what? So they, Hutchison and Kato, applied their models, wind models also, to explain recurrent nova case. And they estimated very precise, the wide off mass is 1.37 for USCO case. And so it's so close to the Chandrasekhar limit, so several people are complaining. But at least the this light curve decline rate depends on the wide off mass rather sensitively, and probably I can show you the next one. So this the decline rate depends on the mass of the wide off. So if we believe this accuracy of the observations, the we can constrain its mass is quite close to the 1.37. And for this case, the observationally also, the wide off mass is very close to the Chandrasekhar limit. So at this stage, these are consistent. And after initial decline, the star entered the nova, entered the phase of the short period of the steady burning, showing the supersoft source phase, and then cooling down like this, and repeat again. So, it's probably. So I think this kind of evolution is a leads to the type 1A supernova naturally, and the frequency I have not really estimated yet, and so we have to really explore the whole evolution cases along this line, and so the especially the nuclear burning at this high mass white dwarf would be important. How much mass is really ejected after nova explosion has not really been studied yet, I think. Sumner just constructed a stable running in the extreme case, and nobody else really did hydrodynamics for these regions. So because these are the very gravitational potential of the wide dwarf is quite large, so the if the wide dwarf successfully reaches, say, something like 1.3, then probably those stars can go to the Chandrasekhar limit. But those possibilities have not been really well studied yet. Thank you.
Quarter past three.
Oh, so after my talk, there is coffee. Is that
yeah.
The
yeah, I don't.
I'm just
remind you.
I think coffee sometimes is a little
little bit later. Maybe if you would want just a couple of minutes, right? Would that be good, just to stretch the legs a little bit after sitting for an hour?
Otherwise, it's a fairly long session.
I think that's right, yeah. And we can, there'll still be some coffee and cookies left there, right?
It's just getting comfortable.
Very interesting.
Isobars somehow, and there's weird, like, interpretation of the bars.
Don't it recognize my computer? After it has seen all these apples, would it recognize my computer? Why is it starting up? I don't like that.
And so it will alter. Nice pick up on the correlation someplace.
So it's trying to do the right thing here. Your grow to that's engaged with our growth.
So during my talk, I mentioned the Starfield project, how you said it was just the mass bin. Great to use in the back.
Okay. Yeah. If it is small mass and they can get stable binding, it's fine. Of course. I have a. Then I have to change my mind.
I don't have to do two interpolation errors, so I only keep one interpolation error.
You have to see that it actually results.
Right.
Yeah, someone said it's technically very difficult to have very small mass zoning in the equation. It just takes too much time to take. But it's just a technical problem. It takes a year, then you take a station try. But a lot of people are just running models in 1 year for a year.
I had a slide of that, and I was
going to
bring it here.
But then I was looking. So my guess is they use more mass zones. 30% They make a kind of flash.
No, I'm not. No, because it's radiant and flocking. And it will shrink the mass immediately.
Okay, you're looking at my question.
That's a little bit more sophisticated.
So what I'm looking at is if you have these sources in the center and your flow line that is at least there, you see that the medium you're running into is not neutral. What you should be able to think how neutral it should be on parametric forces. So now I'm going back to what we see in the ball we're running is I'm saying it's this far out, it's about this year of minutes after the explosion, and you think that it's neutral. Or actually the scientist. I think that's how I did this. The scientist. And then going back and computing based on these luminosities and time duration recombination, can you get is there a limit that you have to set that this the source in the center has to be so hot or so cold?
Such that
it will not or will irradiate enough. Because the actual supernova blast doesn't do anything. It doesn't
provide anything. But these are for supernova remnants.
This is for remnants. This is for something like, I'm assuming some type of source of photons, UV photons, whether it be a source or other thing in the center. So basically, I'm just saying, okay, if something has this luminosity, it's approximately this many photons that can emit out. So I'm not specifically. Yeah, so just kind of like that, where there's all of these, cavity, you actually get a lot of work.
Another three, but
there's cavity work.
Application of uniforms, uniform.
Can't do, you would never see that.
Roadman interfered with.
Oh, I think that's your, no, I see the generator, but it's gotta be a carbon action point. There's nothing else. Well, I don't have it, Sarah. I think the signal is not in some chambers. Probably no storage.
I was gonna question preferences, but just other bases of work is what I'm asking.
Well, I don't know, my trade is we need to know they're not going. I think some of them. But that's a pretty.
No, that's what. The break was necessary.
I don't want to see these things.
No.
I don't want CBMs.
I was thinking one.
Why is it initially a carbon oxygen in the lane going for? It's not so easy to make a double white door system. The letter was not. But not normally involves CBMs. I just want to take something that looks like maybe 20 years and have this.
It's all right, it's all right.
Don't worry about it. There's quite a few ways to make them. There are all different sorts of combinations of what force you can get. It's not really what they do when they go to the.
Because, you know, I don't insist, because, you know, people are just going to see this thing in me.
Well, not everybody is backless.
Maybe not everybody.
Ken and I may have encouraged him not to come.
We're starting to lose people now, and more leaking than are coming.
The divergence is negative.
Or then I'll close the window because your wind is too strong.
No.
I don't think that's the wind that's getting you.
So, how many are still missing? I think I can start. Now, you have had already a lot of things, you heard a lot of things which I may be repeating because there is quite an overlap between the different talks. So some things I will do a bit rapidly. I would like to very briefly go back into history and tell why we think these things, these super softs, are white dwarfs. And then I will talk a little bit about the source types, which also Roseanne has already done, so I will be going pretty fast. And then my talk will be largely a commercial for the population synthesis people to whom I don't belong, and particularly for Lev Jonsson's work, which you will later hear. My talk is a trailer for that. Like in America, they do everything with trailers. I've seen on these movies which you buy, you know, the first half hour is taken by trailers, right? And so I do the same. What? Now, the discovery of the supersoft is in fact due to the fact that Rose had this very soft channel with a very low energy cutoff. And so these are just count rates in the Rose detectors of Cal 83 and of a stellar corona, which is a few million Kelvin, and of a typical neutron star. In this case, it's a black hole X-ray binary, which typically have temperatures of 10 to the 7, so they come out in the hard channel. And the Rosat channels, the hard channel was something like between 0.3 keV and a few keV. This is the detector sensitivity of the channel, the combination of the telescope and the detector. And the soft channel has this window. And now if you have a 3 times 10 to the 5 Kelvin black body, and notice this is a logarithmic scale. And if you also include hydrogen in the galaxy, which absorbs a lot of the softer photons, then the convolution of this detector plus the spectrum here is just a little bit in the soft channel. And since it's a logarithmic scale, there's basically nothing coming in the hard channel. And this is what indicated that these things really have very low temperatures, because it's nothing in the other channel. Even a stellar corona has something in the hard channel, and of course the normal neutron star black hole sources have most of their stuff in the hard channel. Now, you see also from this detector response that it's pretty hard to really determine the temperature which you get here, because you have only one channel here. So, and yeah, you have to know the absorption, all that stuff. And lucky enough, the Magellanic clouds are outside the galactic plane, and so you don't have much hydrogen, and you can only see the supersofts who are on our side of the Magellanic cloud, because in the cloud, of course, the one which I pointed out was already absorbed, the green one on the picture. It looked a bit harder than it really is, because it was is already, one of the two is absorbed. Now, these sources, Cal 83 and Cal 87, were, Cal means, by the way, Columbia Astrophysical Laboratory. They were discovered with Einstein in 1981. And the people then thought that they were black holes, because black holes have a bright, soft state and a fainter, hard state. And they thought black holes in the bright, soft state might be. And so even still after the 90s, 93, I think, and Cowley still saw there were black holes, because she had, it was so imprinted in her head that it were black holes, that she still saw there were black holes. And of course, the reason why they thought there were black holes, because they also were found to be in binaries. And particularly the Cal 87 is an interesting case, because we look almost in the orbital plane. These are optical light curves, and you would think this is a classical eclipsing binary, but it's totally wrong idea. Because what is eclipsed here is in fact the very heated side of the star here. And when you are in the deep, what looks like an eclipse, you look from the backside at the cool side of the star. And the secondary eclipse is when the accretion disk around the compact object goes in front of the heated side of the star. So it's really, it looks like a classical eclipsing binary, but it's completely different type of thing. Now this one you look under a very high angle probably, but you still see a little bit of this effect of the heated side, which you see under different angles. That's at Cal 83. Now why do we think they are white dwarfs? Well, that is just the law of Stefan and Boltzmann, which you all know very well, which says, of course, that the luminosity is the square of the radius times the temperature to the fourth power. So the radius is, and this is the luminosity in units of 10 to the 37 and a half ergs per second, the temperature in units of EVs, and typically the 40 EVs, and typically they are something like 40 electron volts. And so if you plug in that luminosity, which they have, it's about 10,000 solar luminosities, by the way, in soft X-rays, it's a lot of energy, then you get 9,000 kilometers. And now, the first one to say, hey, they are white dwarfs, was Josh Grindley. He said they are accreting white dwarfs. And if you do that, then it does not work, because you need a very high accretion rate. And that is due to the fact that if you have a black hole or a neutron star, when you accrete on those things, you get an enormous amount of energy, because the gravitational well is so deep. You get more than 10% of mc squared if you drop m onto a neutron star or a black hole. But the white dwarf is such a large radius that you get much less out. And if you compare it to nuclear burning, in those cases, nuclear burning of hydrogen is only 0.007 mc squared what you get out if you have m gram of hydrogen. And so that's negligible for a neutron star or a black hole, but for a white dwarf, it is 30 times more than the accretion. And then we thought, hey, you can divide this number by 30. So you need only 10 to the minus 7 to get the same luminosity out for nuclear burning. Now, in this case, it does not work because with such a high accretion rate, you at the same time absorb the soft X-ray, so they never can come out with this rate. But with this rate, they can come out. And when we realized this here in Santa Barbara, then just Kanemoto came by, and he knew everything about accretion at those rates. And then we knew that this model could really work. So that's the nice thing about this whole idea, that a white dwarf nuclear burning gives much more energy than accretion, and that's the thing why this model works. Now, we already heard that you can do it with a companion which is more massive than the white dwarf, because in that case the Roche lobe shrinks when you when you transfer matter, while the stellar, when the star is a bit evolved, the thermal equilibrium radius of the star does not want to shrink, and so the star will transfer matter on a thermal time scale. And I talked about that already on 9 February, and also Nelson talked about that. And then if the mass is a little bit more than, it's around 1.5 solar mass or more, you get such rates of transfer. So that's, and then the final proof that we are dealing with white dwarfs, this is the system which Ken talked about with this limit cycle behavior in the Magellanic clouds, this 18-hour period, when the X-rays are on, the optical is faint, and when the X-rays are off, the optical is bright, but the whole thing clearly is still burning all the time, but one time it comes out in the optical, the other time it comes out in the X-rays. But the crucial thing here is that in that system, you have, with the emission lines, you see satellite lines, like in SS433, and they are about 60, 70 angstrom shifted with respect a blue shifted line and a red shifted line, and corresponding to outflow velocities of about 4,000 kilometers per second, and that's what you just would expect from a white dwarf, because typically jets or winds come out with the order of magnitude of the escape velocity. In the case of a neutron star or a black hole, it would be half the velocity of light or so, but here it comes out only with 4,000 kilometers per second, and that's what you typically expect from a white dwarf. So that's also really a proof that we are dealing with a white dwarf, and we see the outflows, by the way, which Kent was talking about. For this system. Now, yeah, this you have seen already many times. Roche lobe overflow is one way in which you can get mass transfer or mass on the white dwarf, but of course another way is stellar wind. And I showed this picture also in my 9 February talk here. If you have a white system with a red giant companion, the outflow velocities of winds are very low, only 10, 20 kilometers per second. And then the Bondi-Hoyle accretion rate is very large also, because the matter from all around will be captured by the white dwarf. And you can get also a high capture rate if you have a red giant companion. So a symbiotic star can also do it. Now, in a cataclysmic variable, the companion is less massive than the white dwarf, so you would have this situation. But the classical close binary, or what the Russian group calls the algol supersoft sources, they have a companion donor which is more massive than the white dwarf, so there the Roche lobe is larger. So, but you basically could expect these three types of systems, the algols, yeah, the CVs. If in some way or another they are able also to transfer a lot of matter, or if they have this afterburning effect, that after an outburst, a nova outburst, some hydrogen is unburned, stays behind unburned, it may still keep burning for a while. And then, of course, the symbiotics you could also expect. And that is indeed what then the Rosat group found. And there's a picture from 10 years ago, that in the LMC, you see there is a CV, there are four of these close binary, say Cal83, Cal87 types. In the SMC, a CV, a symbiotic star, yeah, planetary nebula nuclei. They can also look like a super soft source, but they can be just single planetary nebula nuclei. And then here in our Milky Way, we have also symbiotics and CV types, and these classical binary CAL 86, CAL 87 type.
The more now CDN systems in the galaxy, or?
Well, this guy is above the gap, and this guy is also above the gap. In the LMC, in the SMC, they happen to be above the gap. In our galaxy, strange enough, they are below the period gap. I don't know why they do that, by the way, but I've no idea.
Well, I checked this yesterday against a couple of dogs. And then discovered that the real super soft sources, the speed is about 6 hours and about 3 hours.
Okay.
And old body.
Okay, so they are both above and below the gap of
energy. In your paper, they can be stretched.
Now, this is a picture you also have seen both from Nelson and from me already, but it's original due to Roseanne and Saul Rappaport. The origin, of course, of CV binaries, but the same for the what we call the closed binary supersofts, is just common envelope. You have a large red giant with a degenerate core, a smaller mass companion. At some point, the red giant engulfs the companion, it spirals in, and out comes a system consisting of this degenerate core and the smaller mass companion. And there is, of course, in nature no reason why the companion should be not above one solar mass. Typically for a CV, it's below one solar mass, but they could be anywhere from one solar mass to anything, 2, 3, 4, 5. And when these things are more massive than the white dwarf, you get these closed binary supersofts. Now, I would like particularly to talk about the numbers, and Roseanne also mentioned this, of course, in her talk, and she and Saul were the first ones to do real population synthesis to see how many of such systems you can produce. So that was the real first paper on this. Then Lev and colleagues had a very big paper. Roseanne and Saul particularly focused on these closed binary systems, which the Russians call the Algol supersofts. Lev, in fact, in his paper, looked at all the three types, and also still another type which might exist in nature, helium accretors. And then later, in later years, they have still refined this a few years ago, and we'll talk about that too. And recently, there were papers by Podziadlovsky and his colleagues also on population synthesis, and by the way, they obtained results which quite well agree with what the Russians get. Now, this is a picture I think Roseanne has already shown her own pictures, but I wanted just to show one of her pictures from the simulations. At that time, in 1994, we knew a number of these closed binary supersofts, and interesting is to see what the companion masses typically were, which came out of the simulation. They are typically between, say, 1.2 and 3 solar masses. The white dwarfs, this is a linear distribution. You can make them grow because you have a big enough reservoir here. And the binary periods did reasonably fit. I mean, seeing how many uncertainties there are in all these calculations, and Roseanne also already mentioned the numbers which were rolling out of these simulations and the numbers inferred from the observations. Well, it's still big. It depends on the input parameters, but they can vary by an order of magnitude, but it's not unreasonable. But then, of course, what Lev and his colleagues did, they also looked at the cases where you have accretion below the lower limit for steady burning, because there where you have weak flashes, the idea is you can retain the matter. Those are not nova explosions. But even if you have nova explosions, there was work by the Israelians, people, Schwarzman, Kovitz, and Prialnik, who showed that not all the matter in a nova has to be ejected, and they gave a certain way to calculate from the expansion of the envelope and in the nova how you could calculate how much mass was retained. And Lev and his people put this all, Lev Jungelson and his people put this all in their simulations. Yeah, and now there's also a picture. As I said, this is a trailer for Lev Jungelson's talks. I took his diagram of what all can come out of a binary system. You start with two unevolved binaries, pretty wide. One of them becomes a giant with a degenerate core. You get a common envelope phase. Out of this comes a white dwarf plus a main sequence. This one is much less massive, presumed, so not yet evolved. A white dwarf plus a main sequence companion that could be a progenitor for a supersoft or for a CV. If it is a very close system, you will be in this case of a supersoft algol type or a CV, which might then possibly go to a supernova 1A. If it is a wider system, then you give the other star, the lower mass star, also the possibility to evolve, to make a big envelope, capture the white dwarf in that envelope, and then you go to make double white dwarfs. Alternatively, if this one does not develop a degenerate core, but at that time is just helium burning, you may also go into a case where the common envelope produces just a helium burning helium star plus a white dwarf in a binary. And so then you would get some kind of object with a helium star companion. That's another channel. And among those white dwarfs, you still have possibilities that the second white dwarf is a helium one or a carbon oxygen one. And those systems we know, the AMCVN systems and the double white dwarfs, the COCO ones, we know also nowadays. So those are possible channels. And then, of course, in very wide binaries, you can make symbiotic systems also. So these are five possible channels. It's a lot of bookkeeping if you want to do all these simulations, but Lev and his colleagues have done this very carefully. Now there is a lot of things which go in there. Roseanne mentioned 17 possible parameters. I thought with five parameters you could already fit an elephant or something like that. So 17 is really...
Look at all the bumps.
What? You can make it walk even, yeah. I think you... Lucky enough, we have observations to compare with. And from the observations, you can get constraints on a number of the parameters. And so it's not that bad as that you have 17 free parameters, certainly not. But it's a very crucial phase is this common envelope phase. And in the common envelope phase, yeah, there is a parameter, which we call the efficiency parameter. And for some reason or another, always, if you don't know what the parameter is, we call it alpha. We were discussing this over lunch also. And this is the alpha for common envelope. And this is one of the possible ways to approach this. You say that you take the mass of the envelope as delta m, you have to bring out of the system. You have to do this against the gravitational potential of the initial mass of the accretor and the initial mass of the donor. The accretor is the core of this red giant of which this is the envelope. And this is the initial orbital radius. And of course, if you put the gravitational G in front, then you have here the binding energy. And then you compare this with the binding energy in the new orbit, the final orbital radius, the initial orbital radius, the final masses of the two stars, the initial masses of the two stars. You say that the energy to expel the envelope you take from the drop in potential energy of the orbit. This is what goes into the common envelope evolution. And of course, this parameter is not well known. A value of 1 is not an unreasonable idea, comes out of simulations which Ron Tam and other people have been doing, but completely sure you are not about it. Now, this is then some of the results from this first paper by Lev and his colleagues. Cataclysmic variables, the total number, the burst rate, the total number in a galaxy is of the order of 10 to the 7. Here, the close binary supersoft like systems, 2.4 times 10 to the 5, symbiotics, rather small number. Although the formation rate is high, their lifetimes are very short. Double degenerates. Anyhow, then you have, of course, you have those systems, but if you have too much mass transfer, you're not going to see them because they will be shrouded. So you have to correct for that shielding, and out of that come then the numbers of the two types here, and also the symbiotics which they predict. And then, of course, you have still to convolve it with the hydrogen in our galaxy, and then come out what you would really expect to see. And, well, these numbers are not too far off from what we really see. And now, of course, the whole program, which the code which Lev used, was quite different from the one which Roseanne used. But he tried then to adapt his parameters such that it looked like your code, and then the numbers which came out were not so different from your numbers, so it looks like this could work. Now, what does come out for the masses of the white dwarfs? This is from these simulations from 96. You see the CVs and the close binary supersoft, the algols, have indeed starting masses which go up to the Chandrasekhar limit, while the symbiotics don't have that. So the symbiotics did not look like a good progenitor group for if you would like to make supernova 1As. Actually, these are logarithmic scales, and it looked a bit different from your graph, but if you make it a linear scale, it looks actually quite a bit like what came out of Roseanne's. Now, Lev and his colleagues have recently redone a lot of these simulations and refined all this work. And what came out of this, and of course there are parameters which you have to put in, like this alpha for common envelope, you can take one, you can take two. Two is for the case that you say, oh, the envelope itself has already some energy to push itself out, because red giant envelopes in general are being lost anyhow. So you could make the efficiency a bit higher. Then there is, you have to put in the simulations also timescales for the mass transfer, and this is just a parameter with which they took the mass transfer rate such that it is alpha thermal times the thermal time scale, and then you can vary that parameter. But the largest numbers which they got out of this for possibility in our galaxy for the rate of 1As is of the order of 0.2 times 10 to the minus 3, what you see here. And 1A means that the star was able to grow to the Chandrasekhar limit. I must say that in the simulations, they have done similar things to Hakuchō, or how do you pronounce it? Kato. Anyhow, these winds, so for the case that you have more than the upper limit, and as a similar type of assumption is put in the simulations. Then the ones who grew to the Chandrasekhar limit, what were the donors in these simulations? They're typically, there is one island. These are post-main sequence stars, typically around two solar masses, and another group of main sequence donors which are closer to three, like what you also mentioned. And these are the starting masses of the white dwarfs in these simulations. And the blackness of these pieces is the rate which you get from these various parts Well, this has all been published, but you can take it from the literature. Now, the important thing is to look how do these close binary supersofts, these are the close binary supersofts, how do their numbers and rates compare with what you would expect from the double degenerates. And Lev did a simulation for that, and taking a starburst. So you take a starburst which takes place, and then you just wait in the course of time what is going to come out in the terms of rates of double degenerates and of these close binary supersofts. And then you see that between something like 300 million years and a few billion years, there is a large bump of these close binary supersoft systems. At earlier times, the double degenerates dominate, and at later times also. Now, of course, this all depends on what you use as input parameters. And this recent simulation, which Podsiadlovsky and his colleagues did, they again used this prescription that if the rate is above the critical, the top, the maximum rate for stable burning, that you use this Hakuchu and Kato idea of winds, this comes from a 1999 paper, and if it is below the lowest limit for critical stable burning, they assume that down to 1/8 of that lower limit, the matter can be retained because the flashes are not very violent. And actually, similar types of assumptions went into the simulations, but in a totally different population synthesis program. They used Eggleton code. I think you used a different Paczynski code in your simulations. And anyhow, but if you then compare, so this was what came out of Lev's simulations for a starburst. So between, say, 300 million years and 2 billion years after the starburst, you have a big peak of these close binary supersofts. And in the case of Podsiadlovsky and his colleagues, this Fürstenwolf, Podsiadlovsky and Hahn, ignore, please, a lot of the diagrams in here. The only ones which are important is the double degenerates and these close binary supersofts. They find, again, with a starburst, somewhere between 200 million years and a few billion years, that the close binary supersofts are very important. They come to a higher peak, about 5 times higher than what Lev found. But looking at the fact that these programs, the codes were so different, and there are 17 parameters going into it, it's quite amazing that it comes out pretty close together, actually. And in this case, they find, actually, that the close binary ones, for a very long time after the starburst, dominate the whole rate of formation of single degenerate collapses. But in late times, again, it's the double degenerates, and also in early times, it's the double degenerates which do something. They come to the conclusion, by the way, that if you look at the observed rates as a function of z, that at the moment it is not possible to make any judgment at a significant level whether the double degenerates or the other ones are doing it. It's nice.
And I was just going to take a note. People that look at the type 1 papers version of Redshift, they're coming up with, quote, delay times that are sort of in 3 giga years. I'm not sure I believe that number, but it's
Well, 2 giga years looks
long.
Three.
These things with single degenerates are cutting off at about a giga year. They're not lasting for 3 giga years. I don't know whether that's significant.
The whole essence of the paper by first Hahn and Sadlowski was that this kind of data you can't say nothing about delays.
This is my last statement from the summary. So the binary population synthesis results indicate that in a population with ages between 200 million and say 2 billion, could be 3 maybe, depends a little on what you do, supersoft binaries would, including the shrouded ones, which where the X-rays don't come out, which like this system in the Magellanic Clouds, which shows this funny off, on-off behavior, can produce between 50 and, in the case of Podziatlovsky and colleagues, 90% of the white dwarfs growing to the Chandrasekhar limit. At other epochs, the double degenerate mergers seem to dominate, but, and this is the final conclusion, comparing all this with the observations, and they did this very rigorously in this paper in 2006, they conclude that at this moment you cannot rule any of the proposed type 1a scenarios at a significant level. That's about all. Yeah.
But maybe the supernovae will help us, right? Because
yes.
There are supernovae are not all the same, and the supernovae in ellipticals are not exactly the same.
Is that so?
Supernovae in the star-forming galaxies.
Okay.
So the shorthand of that is, in the star-forming galaxies, you sometimes see these slow decliners, and the very brightest ones, the 1991T-like ones, you would say. And the fast decliners and the dimmest ones seem to be only with the old population, in ellipticals or in the anyway, what looks to be a little
combination.
So, you know, maybe there is some part of this story that's not just about stellar evolution and timing, but also about the property of the supernova itself.
Yeah,
that
yeah,
will help
yeah,
us
yeah.
sort these two things out.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, because that's definitely a clue. The fact
yeah.
that the things that you see in ellipticals not overlap completely with the kind of
okay, but
that you see
that's very important. Yeah, yeah.
So I think that's really important.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, it's the next thing. Beyond, it's another clue beyond this
yeah.
that will help us. I don't know exactly how to use it, but, you know.
No.
Because when everybody says double degenerate, that's all they say. There's no computation, as far as I know, of what that is.
Yeah.
Right. They
yeah.
say, well, it's more than 1.4 solar masses, you know that's going to explode. But there's no computation of the phenomenon in
yeah.
the same way that the people who've done the core collapse have tried to make a connection between the phenomenon and what you observe.
Yeah, but it is difficult because it's 3D. Very 3D.
I didn't say that. You're just going to have to get used to that.
Wolfgang apparently is trying.
Where is Wolfgang? I say, where is Wolfgang?
Double degenerates the same outcome.
Yeah.
Yes, but if you see your star formation 10 billion years ago, then the only mechanism that still can work are double degenerates. The only we know.
Yeah.
Yes, but even in ellipticals, the Maybe. Average age may not be 10 billion.
If there was a starburst a few billion years ago, yeah. If there was a starburst, yeah.
To make ellipticals, they really like to have some mergers in them, not 10 billion
yeah,
years ago.
Yeah, and it's so nice that both, with a totally different code,
yes.
they both get this, you know.
Yes.
Yeah, but how many of the 17 parameters they have in common? Maybe 50.
No, even the formula for common envelope evolution is different in the two codes. So it's not. Yeah, it makes me quite happy. I must say to see it.
Single stars, which don't scan,
Right.
Exchange or not.
Yeah.
I'm sure they're real things, but whether they are type 1a supernovae or not,
that's
yeah. another question,
yeah.
right?
Okay. I think that's another important point, because all of these things will do something. And you know, if you do things with PanSTARRS, LSST, and other these big monitoring programs, and you know, you can no longer, and people are not in the position to really use templates to figure out what all of these things are. I think you'll see a very interesting diversity of things, and maybe we'll be able to work backwards. But you know, Jean-Pierre has gone through all the trouble of preparing a talk, and I know it's late.
Thanks.
Sorry. Okay.
I have a suggestion. Right?
What is your suggestion?
Lev is going to give a talk next week, right?
Uh-huh.
It's almost been given by Ed, so why don't you glue me to this talk? You will give me 15 minutes, okay?
And you'll be here.
I'm here next week.
Okay, all